content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the November 24th, 2023 issue of the Week. The cover drawing this week has a very stern-looking young woman in the foreground. She's ripping in half a flyer that I believe it says kidnapped is the headline, with some of the Israeli kids on it that have been kidnapped. In the background behind her are hundreds of protesters. One has a bullhorn. One has a sign that says End Zionism. One has a flag that says, From the River to the Sea, Let Gaza Live. And somebody's holding out the Israeli flag with the no sign across it, the circle with the red bar through it. The headline is, Hate on the March. Are anti-Israeli protest fueling anti-Semitism? I believe we get that story on the Talking Points page, but we will start with a related article. The main story, Israel raids Gaza hospital and hunt for Hamas. What happened? Israeli forces stormed a Gaza hospital, they said, hit a subterranean Hamas command center this week, ratcheting up international concern over the growing humanitarian crisis inside the Palestinian territory. Israel said it conducted a precise and targeted operation inside Al-Shifa Hospital, where thousands of civilians have sheltered to escape more than a month of bombing. Fighting around Al-Shifa and shortages of fuel and medical supplies had already created desperate conditions inside Gaza's largest hospitals. Doctors and patients described surgeries performed without anesthetic, infants dying because incubators lacked power, and decomposing corpses buried in mass graves in a courtyard. Israel said it found a command hub, weapons, and combat gear at the hospital. The White House said it has intelligence that shows Iran-backed Hamas used Al-Shifa and other hospitals to hold hostages and support military operations. Top UN aid official Martin Griffiths said he was appalled by the raid, adding, hospitals are not battlegrounds. Israel continued to resist international calls for a ceasefire, but said it would begin letting in some fuel for humanitarian use and allowing four-hour pauses in fighting to facilitate aid operations. Some 70% of Gazans now lack access to fresh water, the UN said, and more than 11,000 have died during Israel's offensive, according to the territory's Hamas-run health ministry. In retaliation for daily rocket and drone attacks on U.S. troops in Iraq and Syria, the U.S. targeted Iran-backed militias in eastern Syria with airstrikes, killing at least eight fighters and destroying a training center used by Iran's elite Revolutionary Guards. There have been at least 57 attacks against U.S. forces in Syria and Iraq since mid-October, said the Pentagon, wounding at least 56 service members. What the editorial said. President Biden has once again played into Hamas propaganda, said the New York Post. He has called on Israel to protect Gazan hospitals and civilians and be less intrusive. But we didn't hear him demand that the terrorists stop using innocents as human shields. Israel is doing its best to minimize harm to civilians that Hamas is shamelessly putting in harm's way. It is Biden's moral duty to be clear about who's really to blame here. The hospital raid underlines the brutal fact that no one is safe in Gaza, said The Guardian. And Israeli forces terrified already suffering patients at Al-Shifa, a second major hospital, Al-Quds, suspended operations amid Israeli strikes and heavy fighting. Israel had a right to defend itself following Hamas' October 7th massacre of 1,200 Israelis, but with death and destruction wreaked on such an immense scale, the insistence that this is a proportionate response becomes unsustainable. What the columnist said. As civilian deaths mount, the Biden administration is getting increasingly frustrated with Israel, said Courtney McBride in Bloomberg. Administration officials describe a growing number of difficult conversations with their Israeli counterparts and growing rancor in the White House as it calls for restraints go unheeded. Meanwhile, Biden's unflinching support for Israel has sparked growing dissent within his administration, said Joey Garrison in USA Today. More than 500 U.S. officials from across 40 government agencies sent him a letter this week calling for an immediate ceasefire and de-escalation of the conflict. My question for those decrying the hospital raid, said Jim Garrity in National Review, is what would you like Israel to do? For years, there's been copious evidence that Hamas operates within hospitals, part of a deliberate strategic choice to make the line between military operations and innocent civilians as blurry as possible. This week, Israeli forces reported finding guns and explosives beneath a children's hospital in Gaza, along with evidence hostages had been held there. Declare hospitals off limits to Israel, and you can be certain Hamas will hole up there to plot more massacres. The terrorist group's war tactic poses agonizing moral dilemmas, said Jason Willick in the Washington Post. And it's one Israel's critics must understand as they claim the moral high ground. To say that Hamas uses civilians as shields and counts on their bloodshed to score propaganda wins is to invite spurious claims of racism. But it's a fact. And it's one reason why Israeli leaders never tried to fully destroy Hamas in previous clashes, until the scale of its butchery on October 7th left them no choice. Now Hamas is facing the consequences, and tragically, ordinary Gazans are facing them too. Controversy of the week. Abortion rights, a losing issue for Republicans? Voters keep sending the same message to Republicans on abortion, said S.E. Cupp in the New York Daily News. Don't mess with our reproductive rights. In Ohio, a red state that voted twice for Trump, voters last week decided overwhelmingly to enshrine abortion rights in the state constitution, becoming the seventh state to protect abortion access since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. And in Virginia, voters thwarted Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin's plan for a supposedly reasonable 15-week abortion ban, handing control of the state house to Democrats. Yet, despite these losses, there's no sign the GOP plans to shift strategy. They're in a catch-22, said Molly Jongfast in Vanity Fair. If Republicans pivot, their staunchly anti-choice base will rebel, double down on bans, and they'll alienate mainstream voters needed to win the presidency. Polls consistently show that more than 60% of Americans think abortion should be legal in all or most cases. So unsurprisingly, some Republicans have decided voters, not their unpopular ideas, are the problem. A group of Ohio state lawmakers is now seeking to strip judges of their power to interpret the new abortion rights amendment. Some in the Republican establishment will try to shut up the pro-lifer, said Timothy P. Carney in the Washington Examiner. That would be a mistake. But it's also misguided to think the long legal battle to overturn Roe ended the war to protect the unborn. The next stage is changing our culture to one that truly supports families. Good luck with that, said Michael Brendan Doherty in National Review. Our individualistic, achievement-obsessed culture tells young people that bringing a child to term will wreck their family's prospects. In previous generations, large networks of kith and kin supported parents, allowing them to have many children. The modern American way of life, by contrast, promotes barrenness and atomization. Voters rightly detect a whiff of hypocrisy from Republicans on the issue, said David French in the New York Times. The Trump-era GOP has become less libertarian but more libertine, demanding no restraints on its members' behavior, but eager to coerce others to behave as it sees fit. This movement rejected COVID and vaccine mandates, contributing to an estimated 318,981 vaccine-preventable deaths, yet tells women to carry unwanted, potentially hazardous pregnancies to term. Given this rejection of self-sacrifice, is it any surprise many Republicans in Ohio voted against abortion restrictions? Many Democrats now hope to ride the post-Roe backlash to victory in 2024, said Michael Baharin in The Liberal Patriot. But the electorate that turned out last week, which was heavy on highly engaged, college-educated voters, will look very different from next year's electorate. Among those voters will be many who have soured on President Biden and care about other issues like the state of the economy. But the abortion issue isn't going away, said Ed Kilgore in New York Magazine. Abortion-related referenda will appear on ballots next year in New York and Maryland, blue states with important swing districts, and advocates are trying to get measures on the ballot in Arizona, Florida, Nevada, and elsewhere. Democrats will try to exploit their abortion advantage at every level, and Republicans have only themselves to blame. They turned abortion policy from a matter of judicially enforced rights to political football, and now cannot close Pandora's box. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for the well-born. After fashion house Dior released Bon Etoile, a scented water for babies and children, retailing at $230 per 3.4-ounce bottle, Bon Etoile captures the tenderness of childhood with the notes of pear, wild rose, and white musk. It was a good week for excuses. After a Tasmanian woman called her office to say she'd be late because a 1,300-pound southern elephant seal named Neil by locals was blocking her from reaching her car. Amber Harris says she sent photos to employers so they knew it was legitimate. It was a good week for impermanence. After a new island appeared in the ocean off Iwo Jima, Japan, formed by a 16-day undersea volcano, the island is only 328 feet across, with a crumbly foundation that means it may not last very long, according to volcanologist Yuji Usui. But it was a bad week for Senator Tim Scott, who abandoned his GOP presidential bid this week. South Carolina senator pitched himself as a happy warrior with an optimistic message, but never climbed above single digits in the polls. The voters, Scott said, are telling me, not now, Tim. It was a bad week for ventilation. After a Titan Airways flight from London to Orlando had to turn around after crew noticed some cabin windows were missing panes. Passengers reported the flight was noisier and colder than they were used to, according to an incident report. Finally, it was a bad week for decorum. After Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, Republican from Oklahoma, challenged Teamsters President Sean O'Brien to stand your butt up and fight during a Senate hearing, Mullen, who accused O'Brien of insulting him on social media, said he was defending Oklahoma values. And a short in other news piece on this page. Trump's kids take the stand. Donald Trump Jr. returned to the Manhattan witness stand in a $250 million civil trial this week to gush about his visionary father, who, along with his two eldest sons and business associates, stands accused of defrauding banks and insurers by inflating the value of their assets. Trump Jr. spent 2 hours describing the family holdings, saying his father's ability to create value is a part of his magic. A lawyer for New York Attorney General Letitia James attempted to halt a slideshow presentation titled The Trump Story, but Justice Arthur Engoron allowed it to proceed, saying, "Let him talk about how great the Trump Organization is." Former President Trump's daughter, Ivanka, also testified, answering, "I don't recall at least 24 times when questioned about particular deals or relationships with banks." Briefing this week is titled "The Threat on Israel's Northern Border." As the Israel-Hamas war rages in Gaza, could the Lebanon-based Hezbollah enter the fray? What is Hezbollah? A Shiite Muslim political party and militant group based in Lebanon. Formed by revolutionary guerrillas, the Iran-backed Hezbollah has been designated a terrorist organization by the U.S. and many other Western nations. But the virulently anti-Israel group functions more like a state within a state in Lebanon than a traditional terrorist outfit. It has dozens of lawmakers in the Lebanese parliament, runs an extensive network of social services, including clinics, schools, and youth programs, and has a lucrative smuggling and money laundering operation. With a highly trained military wing, Hezbollah has been called the world's most heavily armed non-state actor. It has some 20,000 active fighters and 30,000 reservists, as well as a massive arsenal of small arms, drones, and an estimated 150,000 rockets and missiles, including several hundred long-range missiles that can reach across Israel. "They are arming to the teeth," said Navid Ahmed, a Middle East-based analyst. "It's a very skillful and advanced military organization." What are its roots? Hezbollah formed in 1982 after Israel occupied southern Lebanon and sought to quash the Palestinian militants based there. The region's largely Shiite population was caught in the crossfire and took up arms against Israel. Seeing a chance to spread their Islamic revolution, Iran's Shiite rulers provided funding and training to several Lebanese Shiite groups, which united under the name Hezbollah, or Party of God. The group pioneered suicide bombing as a weapon of war and won credit from many Lebanese when Israel withdrew in 2000. 6 years later, Hezbollah sparked a new war with Israel with a brazen cross-border raid in which it killed 3 Israeli soldiers and kidnapped 2 others. The month-long fight, in which some 1,100 Lebanese and 159 Israelis were killed, ended in stalemate. Hezbollah's next major engagement began in 2012 when it sent thousands of fighters to help Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, a member of the Shiite offshoot Alawite sect, to crush a Sunni uprising. The group's fighters battled alongside Russian forces, experienced brutal urban combat, and emerged a formidable military force. What does Hezbollah want? To eradicate Israel, which Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah has called an aggressive, illegal, and illegitimate entity. In its founding manifesto, Hezbollah vowed to create an Islamist state in Lebanon, which has a substantial Christian population. It has since softened that goal, unveiling a new political document in 2009, and said the group supports true democracy. Hezbollah also serves the regional interest of Iran, which the U.S. says provides up to $700 million a year in funding. But while it's linked ideologically and politically to Tehran, Hezbollah has a great deal of its own autonomy and shouldn't be understood as a traditional proxy, said Middle East specialist Thanasis Kambanis. What is its relationship to Hamas? Hezbollah is a long-term ally of the Palestinian terrorist group, which is also backed by Iran, but relations have not always been warm. The Shiite Hezbollah and Sunni Hamas backed opposing sides in Syria's civil war. Hamas reconciled with its Lebanese counterpart in 2019 when it became clear Assad would remain in power. Some Hamas officials have said that Hezbollah and Iran helped train and equip its fighters for the October 7th massacre in Israel. Nasrallah denies the claim, saying the slaughter of 1,200 Israelis was a 100% Palestinian operation. But Hezbollah has expressed full-throated solidarity with Hamas following the atrocity. Our hearts are with you, a top official said at a Beirut rally on October 8th. Our history and guns and our rockets are with you. Such rhetoric has raised fears Hezbollah may join the war, as has a rise in clashes along the Israel-Lebanon border. What's happening there? Since October 7th, Hezbollah has repeatedly attacked Israeli positions along the frontier, while Israel has struck at Hezbollah targets inside Lebanon and Syria. More than 70 Hezbollah fighters have been killed in clashes, according to the group, while Israel says at least 8 of its soldiers have died. Villages and communities on both sides of the border have been evacuated. Amid growing fears that Hezbollah will launch an assault, raising the odds of a wider regional conflict, the U.S. has moved warships into the eastern Mediterranean and warned the group to stand down. In public statements, Nasrallah and other Hezbollah leaders have walked a careful line. In a recent speech, Nasrallah threatened escalation and said that all scenarios are open, but he stopped short of declaring war, and experts say there are strong reasons to believe he won't. Why might Hezbollah stay out of the war? Lebanon has been in a dire economic crisis since 2019, with its currency losing 98% of its value and more than two-thirds of the population sinking into poverty. Economic woes have cut support for Hezbollah, which last year lost its majority in parliament. The public has little appetite for war, and if it dragged into one, Hezbollah's achievements over the past 30 years will go down the drain, said Hilal Kashan of the American University of Beirut. Some experts think Iran does not want its prized asset weakened by a major conflict, but others say it will be hard for the linchpin of Iran's axis of resistance to stand by as Israel occupies Gaza. As tensions rise, there's plenty of room for miscalculation or retaliation spiral. The situation, said Hussein Ibish of Washington-based Arab Gulf States Institute, could easily get out of control. Hezbollah's U.S. targets. Before al-Qaeda attacked the U.S. on 9/11, Hezbollah held a grim record. It had killed more Americans than any other terrorist group. Its first strike came in April 1983, when a suicide bomber in a rigged pickup rammed the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, killing 63 people. 6 months later, a suspected Hezbollah agent drove a truck laden with 12,000 pounds of TNT into a U.S. Marines barracks in Beirut. The blast killed 241 U.S. personnel who were in Lebanon as part of an international peacekeeping force. Hezbollah was thought to have orchestrated the 17-day hijacking of a TWA flight from Athens to Rome in 1985. The hijackers shot dead a U.S. Navy diver on board after their demands for the release of hundreds of Lebanese Shiites in Israeli prisons were not initially met. Hezbollah has never struck inside the U.S., but according to a 2022 U.S. government-backed report, it seeks to develop the operational capacity to do so. FBI Director Christopher Wray recently warned of the increased threat of attacks inside the U.S. by Hezbollah and other Islamist groups. "We are in a dangerous period," he said. Time for a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. Max Boot from the Washington Post writes, "We have met the enemy. The biggest threat to the United States is not China or Russia or other external threats," said Max Boot. "It's our own political dysfunction. The U.S. remains fundamentally strong with the world's biggest and most resilient economy, the most powerful military, and 50 allies, compared with a handful for China and Russia. China's once booming economy has stagnated due to poor central planning and an aging and shrinking population. We remain the world's only true superpower and an indispensable nation, keeping rogue actors like Vladimir Putin and Iran in check. But extreme partisan warfare and a growing isolationist movement have put us on the road to abdicating that critical role. A divided Congress cannot even pass a budget or agree on military aid to embattled allies Israel and Ukraine. If Donald Trump and his America First Brigade regains the White House, he'll likely abandon Ukraine, pull the U.S. out of NATO, alienate allies, and cripple our nation's global power. A host of enemies, including Nazi Germany, Al-Qaeda, the Soviet Union, Russia, and China, have been unable to cripple the U.S. and demote us to second-class status, but Americans may succeed where others have failed." Benjamin Wallace Wells in The New Yorker writes, "Haley is the GOP's best option. Nikki Haley is showing she can land a punch," said Benjamin Wallace Wells. "And if she takes her best swing at Donald Trump, the GOP presidential primary could get much more interesting." That was the clear takeaway from the third Republican debate last week, in which Haley demonstrated she would probably be the GOP's most effective opponent to Joe Biden. Republican voters who like Trump see him as a fighter, so Haley showed off her pugilistic chops. She called Florida Governor Ron DeSantis a liberal on fracking and a liar on protecting Social Security. She reacted with real anger when tech entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy defended his use of TikTok by saying Haley's daughter had been on the app. "You're just scum," she told Ramaswamy with real feeling. Haley even threw punches at Trump, saying he'd added $8 trillion to the national debt and had grown weak in the knees on Ukraine and foreign policy. Trump, she told Republican voters, might have been the right guy in 2016, but no longer was. "It'll be hard to stop Trump, but Haley is rising in the polls, and her willingness to attack him directly and forcefully could mark a turning point." This comes from Venezuela, a government that is also a cartel. A massive leak of classified Colombian documents proves that Venezuela is a narco state, said Camilo Acosta Viada. The hacktivist collective Guacamaya broke into the files of the Colombian Attorney General's office a year ago, retrieving some 7 million emails and documents known as the narco files, and it gave the data to a consortium of international journalists. That group has now begun reporting on its findings, and they show that Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's government and military are directly involved in cocaine trafficking through their very own cartel, the Cartel of the Suns, named for the sunburst insignia worn by Venezuelan generals. The government started out by just accepting bribes from drug dealers, but eventually took over the trade itself. Now Venezuelan officials move some 300 metric tons of cocaine a year, with a street value of more than $8 billion. This information came from a top-secret report by the Colombian military, which considers the trafficking actions of its neighbor a major threat. The revelations call into question the very legitimacy of Maduro, with whom the U.S. just struck a deal to lift sanctions in exchange for holding fair elections. Was it a deal with a national political leader or a drug lord? And it's time for the last word, our feature article. Title this week, The Lonely Fight of the Radical Vegans. The tactics of vegan activists make a lot of people uncomfortable, said Annie Lowry in The Atlantic. So should the plight of animals trapped in America's factory farms. A few hens lay on the ground, unmoving, ill or dead. Many were injured with festering sores on their feet. Some bled from their posteriors. They were likely suffering from a prolapsed cloaca, a painful, potentially fatal condition often caused by repeated egg laying. Others look dirty and ragged, though chickens, given a choice in the matter, tend to be fastidious. Everything, everywhere in this farm for, quote, free-range chickens was covered in excrement. The industrial hangar was so enormous, filled with so many clone birds, that I felt like I was staring into an infinity mirror. It was a moonless night not long ago in Northern California. With me were Alicia Santurio and Louis Brenier, two activists from an animal rights group called Direct Action Everywhere, or DXE. We had met a few hours earlier in a supermarket parking lot where I wrote a lawyer's phone number on my ankle and slipped my cell phone into a Faraday bag, which blocks wireless signals. The three of us got into a car. Its driver stubbed out a cigarette and drove us to an unlit lane amid acres of paddocks and fields. From here, we're going to walk single file, no lights, Bernier said. If we see anyone or hear anyone, we're going to get down and lie on the ground. We hiked silently across dark farmland, shimmying through a series of barbed wire and electric fences. A tense half hour later, we passed a red lagoon filled with feces and chemical runoff and arrived at a set of industrial hangars, home to tens of thousands of birds laying eggs for high-end food stores in the regions. These birds were supposed to have access to fresh air and open space, but the open spaces available to them, wire lean-tos with a few tiny doors cut into the side of the hangar, were free of feathers and feces, meaning the birds were not using them. The lights turned on in the hangar next to us, illuminating thousands of hens. We put on sterile coveralls and booties and went in. This is chicken farming in America. But what I was in was not a farm, not really. It was an industrial operation for delivering animal parts as cheaply and efficiently as possible. For a moment, I entertained the idea of running to the far side of the hangar and flushing the birds out in the cold night air. How often do you have the chance to save thousands of lives? But I recognized how naive the impulse was as soon as I had it. Instead, I just stood there, tears welling in my eyes, imagining what it would be like to live my whole life standing in other creatures' shit, sores on my feet, struggling to move my own weight, my organs falling out of me. The DXE activists were there to document animals' conditions. The group aims to stop the brutalization of farm animals and bring about the end of animal exploitation, ideally by way of a constitutional amendment granting personhood to non-human creatures. In service of that goal, DXE performs undercover investigations, rescues animals, publishes whistleblower reports, engages in nonviolent protest, shuts down slaughter lines, files legal complaints, trains activists, and lobbies the government. But it is perhaps best known for its viral stunts. There was the time the group sprayed manure all over the lawn of an executive at Smithfield, the world's largest producer of pork. The numerous occasions when members have seized the microphone from politicians at stump speeches. The time a DXE member named Matt Johnson pretended to be Smithfield's CEO for a chaotic Fox Business hit. I believed in DXE's mission. About its tactics, I wasn't so sure. I'm a vegan, if an imperfect and non-strident one. Being vegan means foregoing many of life's pleasures. Cheeseburgers, peppermint ice cream, warm sourdough with cold butter. It means absenting yourself from your own culture, not taking the piece of birthday cake, not going to the amazing new restaurant. It means living in a way that makes other people feel judged and uncomfortable. It is exhausting, abstemious, weird. One paper found that omnivores view vegans more negatively than any other stigmatized group, except for drug addicts. It is not surprising that the share of people foregoing animal products has barely changed, at least since at least the late 1990s. Just 5% of Americans say they are vegetarian, and only a sliver of that population, perhaps 1%, truly never eats meat. Globally, the number of animals consumed per capita has nearly doubled in the past 5 decades, as has the share of animals raised in confined industrial environments. Direct Action Everywhere got its start when Wayne Tsuing, a Buddhist and a former law scholar at Northwestern University, moved from Chicago to the Bay Area. In Chicago, he told me, he'd been a comfortable activist, protesting and distributing leaflets about the virtues of veganism, but he had started to become disillusioned with the animal rights movement. Tsuing and some friends created an informal study group to see what they could learn from successful protest movements of the past. Over soy milk and nice cream, they studied how the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, better known as ACT UP, had destigmatized HIV infection, how Freedom to Marry had found a legal fulcrum for marriage equality, and how the Southern Christian Leadership Conference had shaped the civil rights movement. Tsuing cited as inspiration the work of the Harvard political scientist Erica Chenoweth, who has shown that when 3.5% of a population engages in nonviolent public protest, that's 9 million American adults, give or take, political change reliably follows. In 2013, the study group became a direct action group targeting retail stores in the Bay Area. Members camped in front of the meat counter at a Whole Foods and dumped dead chicks in front of horrified shoppers at another supermarket. They posted the videos on Facebook and YouTube, and many went viral. Focusing on radicalizing vegans rather than converting meat eaters allowed DXE to embrace a revolutionary message: animal liberation in one generation, rather than try out Meatless Monday. But the activists adopted some tactics that were unpopular even with vegans. In addition to targeting big grocery chains, DXE went after small businesses devoted to slow food and humane meat, including Chez Panisse, the beloved originator of California cuisine. The aim, Swing told me, was to give vegans a ladder of engagement from low risk to high risk. Pretty high up the ladder were the rescues. Activists carried out dozens of missions to take, well, steal animals from farms and slaughterhouses and put them in sanctuaries. That gives people an individual to identify with. Cassie King, who manages DXE's communications, told me, "It's not just this huge quantity of animals that you can't put a face on or understand what their personality is like or what their suffering is like or what they deserve. Even higher up the ladder were undercover investigations." In the fall of 2021, a few hundred activists gathered on University of California Berkeley's campus for DXE's annual conference, featuring breakout sessions on protest tactics and a keynote speech by the whistleblower Chelsea Manning. Then some 300 protesters got into vans and buses and set out for a Foster Farms chicken farm and processing plant in the Central Valley. A handful of activists had already taken footage of the facility showing birds that had grown so big they struggled to move or even stand. The group's hidden cameras also identified issues with the plant's method of slaughter. At the point of processing, chickens are generally hung by their legs, stunned in an electrified pool, exsanguinated by having their throat slit, and dunked in a chemical bath to loosen their feathers for removal. DXE's footage showed some chickens were missing the stunning tank, meaning they were awake for the next steps. Meatpacking and poultry processing is generally hard on people, too. It's dangerous and, for many, traumatizing work, often done for poverty wages by refugees and undocumented immigrants. Repetitive use injuries are endemic. Grievous accidents are common. Workers are exposed to pathogens and toxic chemicals at high rates. DXE's goal at the Foster Farms facility was to make the assembly line stop, if only for a moment. One phalanx of activists took a moving truck bearing a huge No More Factory Farms banner and blocked the plant's entrance. Three people climbed on top and lashed themselves together using sleeping dragon devices. Four sat by the truck's wheels and did the same. Another phalanx entered the facility and chained themselves to the assembly line on which the birds were stunned, exsanguinated, and defeathered. Finally, a third large group gathered outside to protest. The police arrived shortly after. In the end, more than a dozen activists were arrested and charged with resisting arrest and obstructing or intimidating a business operator. Videos of the crowd roaring when activists walked out with a few rescued chickens went viral. "Everything is about activating people who care about animals," King told me. DXE argues that if more activists were committing civil disobedience, the country's politics and culture would change in a way that would hasten the end of animal agriculture. Yet DXE's understanding of Chenoweth's often-cited work, done with Maria J. Stephan of the Horizons Project, struck me as a little off. It's true that their research shows that nearly every nonviolent protest movement participated in by 3.5% of a population has resulted in political change or regime disintegration, But it finds that in addition to the active support of 3.5% of a population, successful protest movements also have the tacit assent of a larger share. The animal rights movement has failed to engage that broader constituency. There's a big gap still between your average animal-loving American who wants the government to ensure the welfare of the cow and her burger, and your average animal rights protester who wants to grant that cow constitutional rights. Even the country's most prominent progressive politicians, Bernie Sanders, Nancy Pelosi, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Gavin Newsom, have little or nothing to say about animal welfare. And all of them eat meat. I put these arguments to Singh, who is no longer officially on the DXE leadership team, but writes and hosts a podcast about animal rights. I was surprised to get little counter-argument. There's something legitimate about these critiques, he told me. You can't be afraid to be annoying, but you have to watch for things enduring negative reputational impacts. On that moonless night in the egg farm, as Centurio and Bernier finished collecting evidence, Bernier whispered, "Should we save someone?" Centurio nodded, grabbed a chicken, and swaddled it in a jacket. We left the same way we came in, with Centurio carrying the hen outdoors for the first time in its life. On our way out, I noticed a retrofitted shipping container hooked up to a carbon dioxide tank. I knew that such egg operations euthanized hens when they started laying fewer eggs, generally around age two. But the farms have no practical way of tracking how many eggs each individual hen lays. When the production number starts to tick down, farms will typically just gas the whole hangar. Soon, all of these birds, except for the one, would probably be turned into dog food. This is what the debate about animal rights and animal cruelty is really about. This unspeakable horror hidden from us, the suffering borne by billions of creatures on our behalf. I have watched hours and hours of the footage DXE activists have collected over the years. Pigs screaming as they choke to death. Piglets with broken bones trying to stand and nurse from their mothers that are unable to turn around and nuzzle them. Calves thrown into trash heaps, left to die. What I saw enraged and radicalized me. Nothing I saw in my reporting persuaded me that DXE or any other animal rights group has a plausible theory of success. And DXE's efforts at mobilization seem likelier to alienate potential supporters than to persuade them. But if vegans can be annoying, they are also profoundly right. They are burdened with advocating for billions of suffering creatures and being able to help only a few. They are burdened with the futile, enraging task of trying to get people to live by their own articulated values. Why do the vegans always have to explain themselves to the omnivores? The omnivores somehow never have to explain themselves to the animals. This was adapted from a story that first appeared in The Atlantic. And on the Talking Points page, we have anti-Semitism, an old hatred rises in the U.S. There's an ongoing struggle in our streets, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post, over posters of kidnapped victims. After the October 7th atrocities in Israel, flyers have been posted across the U.S. bearing the names and photos of the 240 people taken hostage by Hamas, many of them children. But in scenes shared on social media, pro-Palestinian activists are tearing down the posters, claiming their propaganda to justify Israel's bombing of Gaza. There's nothing political on the flyers, just pleas for innocents who've suffered unspeakable trauma. But that's too much for anti-Semites who can't bear the Jews they cast as evil colonizers being portrayed as victims. It's just one example of how anti-Jewish hate in the U.S. is spiraling out of control, said Judy Maltz. The Anti-Defamation League has reported a nearly 400% jump in anti-Semitic incidents since October 7th, with Jewish students being threatened on college campuses, pro-Hamas slogans being shouted at protests, and synagogues receiving bomb threats. I find what's going on shocking, said one New York University student, who has started removing his yarmulke in public out of fear for his safety. Jew hatred should, of course, be condemned, said David Zirin in The Nation. But we can't conflate anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism. Like many other progressive Jews, I have protested against the bombings of Gaza and unchecked settler violence in the West Bank. That doesn't make me a Hamas ally. Neither does chanting the slogan, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." Representative Rashida Tlaib, Democrat from Michigan, the only Palestinian American in Congress, was censured by the House last week over her use of the phrase, which critics claim is an anti-Semitic genocidal call for Israel's destruction. In fact, it's a cry for peaceful coexistence, for Palestinians to be allowed to return to the land from which they had been forcibly removed. That claim requires willful ignorance, said Trudy Rubin in the Philadelphia Inquirer. I've covered the region for decades, and from the river to the sea means replacing Israel with an Arab-Palestinian state and 7 million Israeli Jews being displaced or murdered. That activist would chant the phrase at protest or gleefully tear down hostage posters shows how far people have fallen into their dehumanization of Jews, said Anti-Defamation League CEO Jonathan A. Greenblatt in Time. Old-fashioned anti-Semitism is driving this, and we must hold its perpetrators accountable. Assuming everything will simply be okay didn't work out for my grandfather in Germany. Manchin, will he go third party in 2024? After years of driving progressives crazy with his stubborn centrism, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia has found a new way to antagonize fellow Democrats, said E.J. Dionne, Jr. in the Washington Post. Manchin announced last week that he won't run for re-election, all but handing his Senate seat to Republicans, and instead will spend the coming months traveling the country to see if there is an interest in creating a movement to mobilize the middle. In other words, Manchin, 76, is considering joining a third-party presidential ticket for the No Labels group. Who's he kidding? There is no middle between the two parties, given the GOP's lurch to the far right. A no-labels run would only drain moderate votes from President Biden. Manchin has never been a team player. He torpedoed worthy Biden initiatives, including voting rights legislation and the expanded child tax credit. But he surely doesn't want to go down in history as the guy who gave us a second Trump term. If a third-party candidate is ever going to win, 2024 could be the year, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. A recent poll of swing states found Trump and Biden claiming 35% and 33% of the votes, respectively, with independent Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in striking distance at 24%. A conspiratorial quack, RFK Jr. will likely hemorrhage support when voters do some light Googling. Manchin, however, is in the sweet spot for a third-party candidate. Slightly left of center on economics and moderate to conservative on cultural issues. Maybe a Manchin run would help re-elect Trump. But based on current polling, it's not running an alternative to Biden that seems most likely to put Trump back in the presidency. A Manchin candidacy would be delightful for Democrats, said Michael Tomasky in the New Republic. He's anti-abortion, pro-fossil fuel, and strongly disliked by progressives. Should he run, this Democrat in name only would steal votes from Trump. Even just a few points in Florida, Arizona, and North Carolina would be enough to smother Trump's chances, said Chris Steierwalt in the Dispatch. Some liberals are upset they won't have Manchin to help defend Senate Democrats' 51-49 majority. But he was almost certainly doomed in a matchup against his deep red state's governor, Jim Justice. Manchin's retirement frees up the party to focus resources on toss-up Senate seats in Ohio, Montana, Arizona, and Nevada. If Democrats somehow keep control of the Senate in 2024, they might have Manchin to thank. On the poll watch, 58% of Americans see China's development as a world power, as a critical threat to American interest, a 17% increase since 2014. This includes 71% of Republicans, 53% of independents, and 52% of Democrats. 52% of Americans think the U.S. is losing ground on the problem of illegal drugs, including 27% of Democrats, 52% of independents, and 75% of Republicans. 74% of Americans say the country has an extremely serious drug problem. And we'll finish out with a quote. This comes from David Bowie, who says, "Aging is an extraordinary process whereby you become the person that you always should have been." It's a lovely thought. And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.